One of our guests on Focus Today sees problems in the nation's law schools. Our other guest says it doesn't stop there. Urbana attorney John Theis is president of the Illinois State Bar Association. That group released a report last month saying that law schools suffer from rising costs and ballooning student debt that restricts the sort of jobs graduates can afford to take. Our second guest, Stephen J. Harper, says his own law school experience and legal career were very rewarding, but in his new book, The Lawyer Bubble, A Profession in Crisis, Harper says the legal profession is threatened by short-term, profit-maximizing goals. The result, he says, are law schools that turn out more lawyers than the marketplace can absorb, and widespread job dissatisfaction among lawyers at firms devoted to the billable hour. I'm Jim Meadows. We'll hear more from today's guests on Focus after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Last month, a special committee of the Illinois State Bar Association, officially called the Special Committee on the Impact of Law School Debt on the Delivery of Legal Services, released a report, and that report said that student loan debt faced by law school graduates was hurting the legal profession. In short, it said that that debt forced new lawyers to stay away from those jobs in the legal profession that pay less, including pro bono work, legal aid, our government jobs, work in rural areas, or work at rates that the middle class can afford. The report also raised questions about the level of preparedness that law school graduates have as they begin practicing law. The report makes recommendations about how a legal education should be financed and what educational standards law schools should meet. Urbana attorney John Theis is president of the Illinois State Bar Association, and he joins me in the studio today. Mr. Theis, welcome to Focus.
Jim, it's good to be here.
And Stephen J. Harper, our other guest this morning, graduated from Harvard Law School. He spent 30 years as a litigator with the big Chicago-based law firm Kirkland & Ellis. He writes in his new book, The Lawyer Bubble, A Profession in Crisis, that he has no complaints about his own education and career, but that there is a lot wrong with the way the law is taught and practiced in the United States. Stephen Harper is currently an adjunct professor at Northwestern University School of Law and Weinberg College of Arts and Sciences. Professor Harper, welcome to Focus.
Thanks for having me on. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, question for the both of you. You seem to have had both good careers in the legal profession, and your law school days, well, they aren't quite ancient history. So when, in your opinions, let me start with you, Mr. Theis, when did things go wrong?
Well, first of all, I'm delighted that you're interested in talking to Professor Harper and me about what I think is a very important question for society, and that is the ability of our profession to meet the legal needs of the citizens. And I'm president of the Illinois State Bar Association, so my focus is Illinois, but as Professor Harper has noted in his writings, this is really a national issue. It became pretty obvious to me over the last certainly 10 years that what we were experiencing in the training of lawyers was unsustainable. And the strongest indicator of that was what was happening with law student debt. I represent 32,000 lawyers in Illinois, which is it's the largest legal organization in the state. And when I go around and hear about the difficulty people are having in hiring young lawyers in certain jobs, I have to pay attention to that. And a lot of the reason for that problem is law student debt. So I would say that it really dates from when those debt amounts started increasing so heavily.
Professor Harper, is that when you would put the starting date of law school's woes?
Yeah, if you had to pick a single year that was the watershed event, I would say 1987. Let me tell you why. That was the first time that U.S. News and World Report ever came out with law school rankings. And it took a few years. They started with initially 20 of them, and it took a few years. But by the 90s, the methodology behind the law school rankings was driving the behavior of many, many deans. And now I think it drives the behavior of almost all of them. And that's a problem because it incentivizes expenditures without regard to the value that it's providing to a student's education. So what John says is exactly right, and I commend him for the task force that he put together and for the recommendations that they've assembled. The tuition problem that he's explained is truly a dramatic one. I mean, if you go back 25 years, you know, in the last 25 years, tuition at law schools has increased by 400%. Well, medical school tuition has gone up by about 60%, and back in the days when I was in law school, it cost a lot more to become a doctor, go to medical school and become a doctor, than it did to become a lawyer. Now those lines have intersected, and it's flipped. The tuition at law schools is now greater than most medical schools, and even in the last 10 years, tuition has doubled. And a lot of that has to do with deans just trying to do what they can to keep moving up these U.S. News rankings, and that means spending money. It means trying to attract as many students as you can. It means trying to enroll as many students as you can to generate revenue so you can spend more money. And, of course, behind all of this are federal loan guarantees and the inability of students themselves to discharge debt in bankruptcy. So it's a terrible vicious circle, and as John correctly suggests, as much as you can do what you can in Illinois by raising the problems through the kinds of reports and task force that John has done, this is a very universal problem in terms of our nation.
Well, we'll continue this discussion with our guests in just a moment, but we welcome you to the conversation as well. If you have a question or a comment, call us here on Focus at 333-9455 or toll free at 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, toll free 800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus 580. And Professor Harper, I was wondering, you've said that the law school prices have essentially quadrupled, far ahead of other graduate school costs. Why did that happen?
Well, two reasons. One, universities figured out that law schools could be money makers. And so as a result, as long as you have, as you've had for years, in fact, you still have an excess of demand in the sense of people who want to enroll in law school, applications exceeding the supply of available spaces. So they kept expanding, and of course, along with the expansion come the kinds of marketing techniques that try to encourage students. So, you know, come to law school, and you'll, next thing you know, you're making a six-figure salary, and you're Alicia Florrick and The Good Wife. What a life. And the difficulty, of course, is that when you're dealing with 19, 20, 21, 22-year-old undergraduates, they want to believe all that. You know, we all labor under confirmation bias that causes us to embrace the data that reinforce our views and reject information and facts that is inconsistent with what we want to believe. So that's sort of been the process, I think. And it's the U.S. news thing is particularly pernicious because, this isn't even unique to the legal profession. The reason I think that U.S. news has created such sway over all this is that we as a society have become obsessed with a kind of short-term metric that allows us to get an immediate evaluation of something without having to actually think it through. So, for example, I've talked to undergraduates who have literally said to me, well, if I get into law school number 22 and law school number 25 in the U.S. news rankings, I'm going to go to number 22, which is a silly way, frankly, if for people who understand the methodology. It's an absurd way, truly, to pick where you go to school, and it leads to all these problems in terms of, as I say, they become profit centers. So as long as you have an excess of demand over supply, you can keep raising the price, which is what's happened with tuition. Law schools themselves don't really have any accountability for students who are unable to repay their loans because they're federally guaranteed and they can't be discharged in bankruptcy anyway. So once they've got the tuition dollars in hand, and I don't mean to suggest that they're all venal, horrible people, but, you know, the market just sort of works, and there's a disconnect between law school dean behavior and ultimate accountability when it's inappropriate.
I want to continue on the question of the U.S. news rankings and other rankings of well, we're talking law schools today, but it might be a broader question for colleges and universities in general. John Thies, before we went on air, you were talking about your own skepticism with such rankings. I don't know if it was part of the State Bar Association report, but what's wrong with the rankings? And the second part of the question is, how do you evaluate a law school if you're trying to pick one?
Well, I don't think that the U.S. News and World Report rankings are a good predictor of the kind of job that the law schools are doing at turning out young lawyers or new lawyers. And so that's where my criticism begins. And I think U.S. News has created an arms race amongst the law schools, and it's not been healthy. And there's been a lot of talk about that, and there's been a lot of talk about the impact of this crisis on the law students themselves and on the universities and on the law schools and on faculty and on. But one of the great motivators for us at the Illinois State Bar Association was the fact that so little had been discussed about the impact on the delivery of legal service, because that's what we were really all about as lawyers, is we're trying to meet legal needs. And so when these law student deans are off, you know, trying to compete against each other to get the best ranking, it misses the point. The point is, what kind of job are you doing at turning out people that are capable of working in a wide range of areas in the law? That led to we had five hearings around the state where we brought people in from all types of practice settings, from legal aid lawyers to prosecutors and defense lawyers to big firm lawyers and small firm lawyers and PI lawyers and on and on. And we asked them, what are you seeing as a result of this problem? And there was a steady drone from the folks that testified that the schools are turning out too many people that are just simply incapable of working in their practice setting. It's problems like young lawyers that can work for a few years and then have to move on because of the income issues. It's the student loan issue. You know, we could talk for hours about problems that have followed from our current structure of student loans. So that's why I think that the arms race for U.S. News and World Report has not been healthy at all for any of us.
I just wanted to go back to a point you made about graduates who are incapable of working in their practice setting. Is that because they are not fully trained for the work they're sent out to do, or is it because if they go into a position that doesn't pay enough, they have to leave it for something else?
It's certainly the latter. It's certainly caused by people that they can't service their debt. They just aren't going to earn enough to do that. But one thing that has happened as a byproduct of this, it's really the economy and the difficulty of getting jobs generally, is that you see more and more people who are going into solo situations, that they're hanging out their shingle. Those people really need to have been trained in things like law office management and, you know, much more practical skills at law school. And so it does suggest that the law schools need to do a better job at those sorts of at training their law students in those sorts of areas.
And I don't know, Professor Harper, is that part of the problem that you saw as you were researching your book?
Yeah, John hit it exactly right. And one of the reasons that you have all of these new graduates now going into solo practice is because there frankly aren't enough law degree required jobs to put all the law graduates to work. I'll just give you a couple of numbers and it'll illustrate the point. Over the past year, that is 2012, we graduated for a record number of law students from law schools, 46,000, 2,000 more than last year. The percentage of law school graduates who got long-term, full-time, degree-required, JD-required jobs was a little over half, 56%. That's stunning, if you just think about that for a second. So you're coming out of law school with a home mortgage but without a house in terms of the debt level. And that creates the kind of problem that John is describing, too. You have this other sort of remarkable disconnect where you do have, by all reports, a massive amount of unmet legal services needs by poor people and those who even middle-class people who can't afford or don't want to, you know, deal with the trying to pay for for legal services. And, you know, the Legal Services Corporation in the last, between 2010 and 2012, saw its funding cut by over 20%. Well, that's 600 lawyers. And so you have this sort of remarkable problem where you're graduating 46,000 lawyers a year, and only half of them, and these are projections, too, for the next 10 years. The Department of Labor Statistics, Bureau of Labor Statistics, projects that over the next 10 years, we're going to create about twice as many lawyers as we have jobs for them, yet at the same time, we have the kinds of problems that John's describing at the lower end of the thing. So it's a really terrible problem, and it's sort of an ironic thing to be talking about 50 years after the famous Supreme Court decision of Gideon versus Wainwright, which of course guaranteed, at least in theory, every criminal defendant a lawyer. But nothing in that decision required any state or anyone else to pay for that lawyer. So it's a very systemic and society-wide problem.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. We're talking about law schools and lawyers with a couple of attorneys. John Thies of Urbana is president of the Illinois State Bar Association. Stephen J. Harper is an adjunct professor at the Northwestern University Law School and author of The Lawyer Bubble, A Profession in Crisis, published by Basic Books. If you have questions or comments, call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Or you can email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a patient listener on line 4 from Belgium, Illinois. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Yes, good morning to you all. Maybe if I might point out, and I'm sure you guys are totally aware of this, but we're the most litigious country in the world. We have more lawyers per capita than any other country. Aren't you being kind of hoisted in your own petard here? We sue people at the drop of a hat for dropping a hat. Is this all necessary?
That's a really good question, and the listener is exactly right. We have about 4 lawyers for every 1,000 people in the United States, compared to, say, the UK, where it's 2.5, or Germany, where it's 1.5. But I think, as John will tell you, if you look at his report, there are massive dislocations or maldistributions, if you will, in terms of the legal talent. So it's one thing if you go to a city like Chicago, and you know there are lots of lawyers in Chicago. Although there is another problem in terms of, you know, lawyers, people who can get lawyers at lower income levels. That is a continuing problem. But you know, I'll let John talk about what happens once you move out into the rural areas in terms of availability of lawyers. But the listener does have a point.
Yeah, the ratio differs greatly between major metropolitan areas and the areas around the state, and that's in our report as well. I think the statistics are a correct assessment of what they are. But I would reinforce the point, though, that the role that lawyers play in society, we have a peaceful resolution of disputes. Frequently, cases are resolved without going to court. That's the first instinct of a lawyer. And I think the perception that the caller has is mostly not accurate. It's painting with very broad strokes. And while there certainly are instances that lawyers would not be proud of, they really are rare.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling. And so we have an awful lot of law school graduates, and I take it this is based on demand. There is a demand there somewhere for people to go to law school and pay what are apparently very high tuition rates. Why is there such a demand if it is so difficult to make a good living and to pay off and to pay off student loan debts to be a lawyer?
That's a really good question, and I'll tell you, for many years, indeed up until last year, if you were to consult any law school's website or the ABA data, you would have found in general, law schools promoting 93 or 94 or 95% employment rates for graduates across all lawyers. In other words, if you took 44,000 graduates in 2011, you could go to data and it would tell you 93% or 94% were employed. What the data didn't tell you, but what the ABA has now required just in the last 2 years, law schools to disclose, is that employed could mean working as a waiter, working as a barista in a coffee shop, working as a greeter in Walmart. It included short-term jobs. It included part-time jobs. It included, if you want to really be cynical about it, it included jobs, part-time jobs, where the law school itself hired the new graduate for a short period of time solely so they could report the graduate as employed on February 15th, 9 months after the student graduated from law school. So one problem is you've got you've had a lack of transparency in terms of what the real situation has been. The second thing I think you've had is really easy money flowing from the federal government in terms of the ability to get loans to cover this stuff. Even if they were private loans, the federal government backed them. So they seem like not that big a deal, and then all of a sudden, the next thing you know, it's piling up and it's piling up, and you're a third-year student, and all of a sudden, all these jobs that were supposed to be there aren't there. The third thing I would identify is sort of the thing I alluded to earlier, and that is, you know, lots of people grow up with this image. I'm sure John did. I know I did. I grew up watching Perry Mason and those sorts of things, and you grew up with this idealized image about what a lawyer's life is going to be like, what it means to be a lawyer. It's an esteemed profession, which I think it is, and don't get me wrong, and I think John would embrace this notion as well. I think being a lawyer is a great and noble calling, and I had a terrific career as an attorney in my firm. But it's not for everyone, and there's a certain amount of reality therapy that, frankly, most universities and colleges don't have a lot of incentive to provide to undergraduates, because aren't they going to be better off? That is, aren't the universities going to be better off if they can show that more of their students go on to professional schools like law schools? In that respect, I've been fortunate because Northwestern has taken a very, I think, good and progressive view of this, which is, you know, let's show students what the profession is really going to be like, the good and the bad. You're not going to all grow up to be Clarence Darrow or Perry Mason or a character on Law and Order. But let's get some balance in the picture, and let's get some true information and force students themselves to confront their own confirmation bias and maybe rethink assumptions that they made in high school or even earlier. One-third of students decide to go to law school before they're out of high school. And so once you lock into something like that, you've got to take some effort to at least get them back to the middle.
John Thies, the ISBA study, does it reach a similar conclusion?
Well, what I want to add to what Stephen just said is I think that the typical person that goes to law school is passionate about a lot of things, and the law, being a lawyer is a good vehicle toward playing out those passions. I want to give you a couple of examples. It certainly influenced me as I decided that I wanted to go to law school and become a lawyer. I think lawyers almost without exception quickly become a part of the fabric of their communities. They are involved in lots of different things. The quality of life that they have through that sort of service is important. It's a factor that I considered. In the last reporting year, lawyers donated 2.2 million hours of pro bono work. I don't think there's any other profession that has done what our profession has done in terms of free service. One of the things that I worked on this year at the Illinois State Bar Association is a campaign called Lawyers Feeding Illinois, where all around the state, lawyers got together and raised more than 1.2 million meals for the hungry. That's the sort of thing that we can do as a profession, and it's one of the things that attracted me to it at the beginning. So there certainly is a transparency problem, and I think that's one good development through the ABA, as Stephen said, over the last several years, to tighten up how we define employment. That's becoming harder and harder for the law schools to do, because this crisis is more and more apparent to prospective law students.
Harder and harder for the law schools to be less than transparent just because the problem is so obvious.
It is hard to hide from this now. As I mentioned to you off the air, I spoke recently at the UVI College of Law and was basically standing room only with these students that are very concerned about it. We've even had, one of our hearings, we had a pre-law advisor that talked about the experience they were having with their undergrads. I just think that it's becoming more and more obvious that this is a problem that isn't going to go away anytime soon.
Before we go to our break, let's say hello to Line 4, Steve in Cisna Park. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Yeah, hi. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I think it's a very important topic you guys are discussing this morning, so I applaud your efforts. there was a program on NPR about a month ago. I want to say Fresh Air, but I'm not sure. And it covered the dilemma that's maybe not on the radar of a lot of people, the common person, but it was a dilemma about public defenders and how they are outgunned, for the most part, by prosecutors, backed by the state with evidence and technicians and what have you. And this gentleman, I believe, wrote a book where he said he was in some town and he thought he was in a third world country because the public defenders would come in, spend less than 2 minutes with the accused, tell them to take the plea deal, and the gentleman would have the orange jumpsuits on. They would be handcuffed to each other. They'd stand up in unison. They'd go in front of the judge, and then they'd be carted off in a bus and taken to prison. And he said that on balance, where you say everyone has the right to an attorney, but the actuality of that is far from what people might think. Today, currently, with the public defenders and the people being charged, they're having less and less time with the accused, and the accused listen to the attorney, and they find themselves maybe innocent, but accepting a plea bargain where they have to go off to prison. I just thought I'd offer that up if your guests would want to comment.
Right? Well, I will, just to say that out of our hearings where we had people come in, we heard from lots of people working in positions like that. Both, interestingly, I think the traditional notion is that public defenders have been outgunned. But we had a prosecutor that came and said that he's having an enormous difficulty in getting people to stay, first to be hired and then to stay as prosecutors because of the inability to service their debt.
Which pays better, being a prosecutor or being a public defender?
I don't have those statistics in front of me.
They're actually remarkably similar. but where they all leave, where they leave for is sort of the second shoe of John's point, which is they're going to leave if they get the opportunity for a more lucrative position, which private firms, although the trend line for private firms has turned down too in terms of income, but even now there's more money to be made in private firms, and if you're sitting with $100,000 of law school debt, which is the average law school debt for 85% of graduates, then you're gonna do it.
That's right, and actually, some of the other testimony on point was we had managing partners that came in and said that they're not that interested in people right out of law school right now because since they haven't been trained to the degree that they want them to be trained, they would rather hire somebody away from another situation, say as a 2 or 3 year attorney, and go to work that way.
So public service work as a prosecutor or a public defender might be a route to go if you can, but can you service your debt load while you're doing
that? It's very difficult to do. You know, there have been studies out there that point to if you take that average number of roughly $100,000 in debt, which by the way is just an average. We had plenty of people that came forward and said that they had $150,000 or $200,000 in debt.
Yep.
And if you apply that, assume a salary of somewhere around $50,000 a year, you just can't service the debt.
We're going to take a short break at this point. We'll be back with more about the problems facing law schools and lawyers with Stephen J. Harper and John Thies. This is Focus on WILL.
During the Gaddafi regime in 1990, Hisham Matar's father was kidnapped and sent to a Libyan prison for opposing the regime. Matar never saw his father again. After the fall of the Gaddafi regime, Matar returned to Libya, where he grew up, to investigate what happened to his father. On the next Fresh Air, he tells us what he learned, which he writes about in the current edition of The New Yorker. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Docha, presenting the 2013 Docha Festival, featuring chamber music events and young people's concerts April 5th through April 7th at the Orpheum Theater in downtown Champaign. A complete list of festival performances is at docha.org.
I'm Jim Meadows, and we're back on Focus with Illinois State Bar Association President John Thies of Urbana and Stephen J. Harper, author of The Lawyer Bubble, A Profession in Crisis from Basic Books. You can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus 580. And I did see a comment, a tweet from Mark, and let's see if I can make this out. Mark is seeking comment from both of you, John Thies and Stephen J. Harper, on integrating bar prep into formal law school education, on the virtues of doing that versus private courses post-JD with high fees. And I'm a little at sea with the jargon there, but maybe you can unpack it for me.
Well, I can, but it's very typical for graduating law students to take a bar review course before the bar exam. In Illinois, the bar exam is given twice a year. The typical graduate would finish in May and take the bar exam in July. And right after graduation, or sometimes even just before, they'd start a bar review course, and it's very expensive. And for a long time, I've felt that this is something that the law schools could and should do to reduce the cost on students. One of the recommendations of this report, as a matter of fact, is that law schools teach a bar review course. There are competing interests in this because, on the one hand, the report focuses on providing students, graduates, with more practice-ready skills. And so the thought is that over the last year of law school, there would be much more emphasis on getting you ready to start. And so the tension is that if there is more of a focus on bar review, that might compete. So there has to be some sort of a balance between the two. But bottom line is that because of the current way that the typical law student does things, it just adds to the debt in a way that we think is unnecessary.
Yeah, the only thing I guess I would add is that it depends, too, on the law school. So that if, for example, you're a, what they call a national law school, Northwestern, University of Chicago, even the University of Illinois to some extent, bar review preparation tends to be state-specific. There are certain common aspects, but the bar review courses typically are geared to unique local rules relating to a particular state. So you'd have to sort of draw a distinction there. Certainly for schools where the vast majority of students wind up staying in that state, I'd probably put the threshold pretty high before I work it into the curriculum as a requirement, although you could certainly make it an elective. It does add to the cost. I have found in general, and I think it was certainly my experience, and my guess is John would agree as well, and I suspect most new graduates would have the same view. The bar review and the bar exam itself in general feels, when you're going through it, like a colossal waste of time, mostly because you're memorizing a whole lot of stuff on a wide range of issues, most of which you'll never, ever have to address. That doesn't mean you don't have to do it, and you shouldn't have some familiarity with it, but it does tend to feel like kind of a discrete exercise that's not going to be of any particular long-term or meaningful long-term value. But I do agree, and I think the increased emphasis on the third year for clinical and experiential kinds of programs is certainly a good result. Although I have to tell you, if I were king of the world, I'd eliminate the third year, but that's just never going to happen.
Yeah, our committee felt strongly that in fact, there were even people that wanted to have more than 3 years. We just think that the third year it should be devoted more toward practice skills and less toward what we would call exotic courses, which... I want to point out that over the last 5 or 10 years, there's been a greater emphasis at law schools on practical skills education. The problem is that it hasn't been at the expense of the exotic classes. So they both, and this adds to the cost. They both have increased. But I do want to applaud the law schools for taking seriously the ABA's call for them to have more practical skills training.
Professor Harper, I wanted to go ask you to talk about the second section of your book. You start with looking at law schools rather critically, but you also look at law firms rather critically, including or perhaps especially very big law firms, maybe not unlike the one where you spent your career.
Right. Yeah, it's a continuation really of, or an evolution, I should say, that's followed similar trend lines to what I was alluding to earlier. That is our cultural obsession, it seems, with short-term metrics in order to maximize short-term profits, but often at the expense of long-term values that matter more but are more difficult to measure. The firms that you talk about occupy about 10 to 15% of all lawyers nationwide. that is the largest 200 or so, 250 law firms, account for about 10 to 15% of all lawyers. But they exert a tremendous outsized influence over the profession generally. That's not to say that they're any better at all in terms of the lawyers or anything else, but they just do. They have a disproportionate impact, I think, on the profession generally. And what has happened there is something kind of analogous, really, to what's gone on with the U.S. news rankings. The difference there is that it's called the American Lawyer Profits Per Partner Rankings, and those started in 1985, and particularly over the last 15 years, have become a different kind of arms race, to use the analogy that John mentioned earlier. Every firm wants to keep beyond this list, that is every large firm of a certain size, and they want to keep moving up the list, and that has implications for the kinds of behavior that goes with short-term profit maximizing at the expense of things like mentoring, collegiality, a sense of community, and even in some cases stability. There was a remarkable failures of large law firms in recent years, most recently last year with the New York firm of Dewey and LaBeouf. And I believe that firms like that and that have gotten into those kinds of problems are sort of living through the consequences of trying to emphasize the short term at the expense of more enduring values that help actually keep these institutions together. John's probably sitting there smiling that he doesn't have to even deal with these places, at least as a place to work. But the other thing that's true beyond any question, really, is that the people who are working in big firms generally, as lawyers that is, have less career satisfaction than either people in smaller firms or than the even less well-paid people who are prosecutors and public defenders. The career satisfaction rates are the lowest among the group who make the most money as lawyers. So there's a paradox there.
They are making a lot of money, but it's not as much fun?
Yeah, I think go back to John's original point. You know, why did you become a lawyer in the first place? And most people, certainly of my generation and John's, would say that I don't know anybody who was my age who went to law school thinking that that was going to be a way that they were going to get rich. You had different ideas and different ideals that caused you to pursue the law as a profession. And the fact that some of the larger firms, many of the larger firms, have become enormously lucrative. I mean, I'll just give you one number to illustrate the point. Back when the American Lawyer Rankings first came out in 1985, these are staggering numbers, the average equity partner profits in a large firm per partner in 1985 were $300,000 a year, which is a stunning amount of money. It's $600,000 in today's dollars, a little more than $600,000. Well, today in that same group, that is the largest 50 firms in the United States, the average equity partner profits is over $1.5 million. Well, no one's going to say, gee, I don't want all that, but nothing in life is free, and I think it comes at a cost, and some of the cost has to do with the satisfaction that you get, because some of the tasks that and the culture that winds up emerging from a place where you're just trying to squeeze every dollar out of it is not always pleasant.
And I'm wondering then, is there any connection between the debt load that law school graduates have to shoulder, and the high salaries that these big firms are able to command? Do they have more graduates to choose from because they have to make more money to pay off those debts?
Right, exactly right. Yeah, they have the first shot at the top graduates at the top schools, and it's for understandable reasons, as John has already explained. When you're coming out with the kind of debt that you're coming out of law school with, that's the sort of place that you're going to try to get because that looks like an awfully good deal. And even if you become kind of cynical about it and say, well, all right, I know there's some downsides to working in these places. And I should qualify all this by saying, too, there are vast differences among firms. Not all. It'd be a mistake to paint all big firms with the same brush. I mean, I had a great career, and I don't come at any of this from a sour grapes position. But the fact of the matter is there are people now who come out of law school with big debt and say, you know, I'm just going to make as much as I can for as many years as I can, burn off this debt, and then I'll go back to the nobility that I thought I was embracing when I became a lawyer in the first place.
Yeah, I actually am familiar with a number of examples of just what Stephen's talking about. People that really saw no choice, they really would love to do, say, public interest law, but they can't afford to do it. They have to go to work at the biggest firms, despite some of the experiences that Stephen's mentioning.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're talking about challenges facing law schools and the legal profession today with John Thies and Stephen J. Harper. I'm going to take a call right now, and I want you to want both of our guests to also start gathering up their solutions to the problems we've been talking about for the last 40 minutes. I want to say hello to Carol in Champaign on line one. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Yes, I had two questions.
Yes, go ahead.
They're not in. I used to watch a local show on WILL or CBS on Sunday mornings from the U of I, from the U of I Law School. Do they not do that anymore?
I don't know myself if the College of Law at the U of I is currently doing a television show. I don't think it's airing on WILL TV anyway, but I don't know if any other station was carrying it.
All right. I wondered if they were still doing it. The other question is, maybe it's not on your topic, but I needed sources of pro bono attorneys.
Where do you go to find pro bono attorneys? I mean,
yes.
It's hard enough to, it sounds like there's a shortage of them anyway who will do pro bono work, but does the Illinois State Bar Association, for instance, maintain a list that people can refer to?
Well, first of all, you may be eligible, depending on the matter, you may be eligible in this area to be served by Land of Lincoln Legal Assistance Foundation. If you call, I don't have the number in front of me, but if you call Land of Lincoln, they can help you determine if you're eligible for their services.
Which of you am I speaking to right now?
This is John Thies. Yeah, you can call Land of Lincoln Legal Assistance Foundation, and you can tell them what the matter is and whether or not you might qualify. The Illinois State Bar Association also maintains a lawyer referral service that is not in and of itself pro bono, but the way to learn about that, you can call 1-800-252-8908. And that's the Illinois State Bar Association's number, and you can ask information about the lawyer referral.
Yes, well, I have tried both of those, and it was with no success. Is there any? I know that you mentioned even that there are lawyers that they're. Are they required or merely encouraged to do a number of hours of pro bono work each year?
They're not. Lawyers are not required to do pro bono work. We are required to report the work we do that's pro bono, but we're not required to do that.
How would I find these lawyers who are doing the pro bono work?
Well, since a large percentage of the lawyers in the state do pro bono work, you could talk to almost any lawyer and ask. To bring the matter up and to determine if that lawyer is interested.
Well, is there any better way to find them than simply to call each one in the book and ask them? Is there any other way of finding them?
I think you've exhausted my resources.
Carol, thank
what
you.
About,
yes, go ahead.
What about Stephen? What about Stephen Harper?
Well, sometimes you can ask the local county bar association. Sometimes in Cook County, for example, there are different programs that where they tap into those sorts of things. So that would be the only other thing I could add to what John's already suggested. Bar Association.
Carol, thank you very much for your call. I'm sorry for the difficulties. Does this is this sort of an illustration of the problem at hand? And I'm going to go from that step to asking you what your recommendations are for the problems that you see in the legal profession today. John Thies, you get to go first.
Well, our report, and I want to explain a little bit about the background, first of all, and that is we had a committee that had undertaken the hearings around the state and done other research and developed this report that you can read, and it goes into much more depth about it. But the recommendations have now, it's gone to the ISPA's Board of Governors, which has accepted the report and has now recommended it to our assembly that will be considering it in June. The recommendations fall into a number of different categories. They relate to things like financing of law school, and so that speaks to issues of should there be essentially, it it's not unlimited, but should there be as vast amounts of money available to students when they go to school? Should there be outcome requirements? In other words, should a given law school be allowed to offer certain loan programs if their outcomes are not as good as they should be? Another category is the accreditation standards. For reasons that Stephen mentioned before, and this was really more in the context of U.S. News and World Report, but many of their guidelines followed from ABA accreditation standards. Should those accreditation standards be changed, for example, to allow more adjunct faculty, which would be less expensive, to allow more focus on teaching and less on scholarship? Do you know right now that the average number of classes that a law professor teaches in a year is three? And the reason for that is so they have so much time to do research. But there's plenty of statistical evidence out there that suggests that research that leads to writing that's not of as much significance as you might hope. Reforms in law school curricula. I think we've already talked about a number of those possibilities. The law school faculty, you know, tenure requirements. Right now, we are treating our law school faculty like they are political science professors. We should have tenure panels that consist of lawyers and judges in addition to faculty members. So that's an example, or a number of examples of some of the ideas that come out of our report. There are quite a few others. We've made a real effort to try to do it in a way where many of these would actually lower the cost.
Stephen J. Harper, can you tell me about some of the recommendations that you make in the lawyer bubble?
Sure, I do. I boil it down to three. First, money. There needs to be a way to hold law schools, deans, and university administrators accountable for problems the problem of too many lawyers and not enough jobs for them to repay their debt. So the way I would solve the money problem would be a two-step process. One, I would allow students to discharge their educational loans in bankruptcy. Right now they can't, which puts them in the same category as alimony, child support, criminal fines and taxes, which is, you know, if you think about it, why do educational loans belong in that box? And you're not going to come up with a very good answer. The second thing I would do on the money piece is I would actually, and this is never going to happen, I recognize that the embedded interests are far too strong, but I would actually require, or allow, I should say, in cases where students did declare bankruptcy and the educational debt was the significant contributor to that bankruptcy, I would allow, in that circumstance, the federal government, who stands behind all these loans, to come back and seek recompense from the law school or the university. Because right now, there's just no connection there between what the law school can get away with and the financial repercussions for the students. The second thing I would do is I would continue all of the transparency that's underway in terms of, you know, getting data out there, you know, everything that people need to do to make informed decisions. Because I think if there's enough transparency about this stuff, eventually people will take a look at the methodology behind the U.S. News and World Report rankings and say, this is silly. I'm not going to pay any attention to this anymore. And then the third thing I would do is I would continue to just pound undergraduates in particular, but prospective lawyers in general, with just some reality therapy. You know, here is what actually being a lawyer is going to mean. Here is what it entails, the good, the bad, the ugly. Here are the job prospects. Here's the debt. We're not trying to talk you out of it. We're not trying to talk you into it. It's a great profession. There are Atticus Finches in the world today. There are Clarence Darrows in the world today. There's a lot of nobility in the profession. I think John embodies much of it in what he does in his service. But those are the three things I'd do at the level of law schools.
Yeah, I think everything that Stephen just said is also in our report. We recommend those as well. The bankruptcy point, I'll just speak to that quickly. Lawyers are loath to file bankruptcy because it's such a statement, or can be such a statement on your ability to manage other people's money. And so I think that Stephen's suggestion on the dischargeability of the debt in bankruptcy is excellent. I think it will be rare. Our report says that it should be only in instances of hardship. In other words, you must demonstrate that you're in a hardship situation. I think that it's a suggestion that has a lot of merit.
And I should note our producer, Lindsay Moon, here at Focus, reached out to a few law schools in Illinois to let them know about the show today. And Bob Rowley, who handles media relations for the law school at Northwestern University, the one where Stephen J. Harper is an adjunct professor at. Well, he emailed us this statement. Northwestern Law School's dean, administrators, and professors are busy working hard to reconfigure the system in constructive ways so that it better serves our students and the profession.
I think that's right, by the way, and I applaud the new dean, Dan Rodriguez, who's taken over the last couple of years, for doing that. And I think I endorse that, actually. I think they are making very serious strides and efforts in that direction.
And John Thies, you spoke at the U of I College of Law on the ISBA report last month, and I'm just wondering what sort of response did you gather from the faculty and the students there and the administrators?
We've had a lot of interesting reaction from academics, much positive. And I will say Bruce Smith at the U of I College of Law has been very supportive of our attention to this very important question. And we had, at our hearings, we actually had five deans that came and testified. So we were also very open to hearing from academics. And we certainly are challenging a lot of status quo. And we don't expect it to be well received by everybody, but we've had a lot of positive reaction.
Well, at this point, we are out of time. We've been talking today about problems facing the legal profession with Urbana attorney and Illinois State Bar Association President John Thies. The report from his organization can be found online at isba.org. And also been speaking to Stephen J. Harper. He's an adjunct professor at the Northwestern University Law School and author of the new book, The Lawyer Bubble, A Profession in Crisis, from Basic Books. And gentlemen, thank you both for being on the program today.
Thank you, Jim. I enjoyed it. And thanks, John. I enjoyed the conversation.
Stephen, same to you.
Welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. That's at will.illinois.edu/focus. We are likely the first result on your search engine under WILL Focus. Focus is live each weekday morning at 10 on WILL AM 580 with a replay at 8 p.m. And you can hear the show streamed and archived at will.illinois.edu. Wednesday on Focus, we look at homelessness in Champaign, Urbana. We'll talk with Beverly Baker of the Champaign County United Way and Nancy Hyatt of the Center for Women in Transition about the services and shelter facilities available in the area and how they measure up to the need in the community. Plus, we'll hear from one woman about her struggle to get back on her feet and recover from homelessness and drug abuse. That's tomorrow's program. Focus is produced by Lindsay Moon. Other members of the Focus team, Pam Dempsey and Kimberly Cronick. Mike Pritchard, our technical director. I'm Jim Meadows.